headlines. Iran's top negotiator at a nuclear deal talks says Tehran wants to see the removal of the unlawful sanctions as the end result of the negotiations. Our exclusive interview coming up. China once again opposes military ties between the U.S. and Taiwan in response to the Taiwanese president confirming the presence of American trainers on the island. And France detains a British fishing vessel and fines another as a row between London and Paris over post-Brexit fishing rights flare up again. Well, welcome from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you for joining us. Iran's deputy foreign minister has told Press TV that the removal of sanctions will be the main focus of the upcoming talks with the parties to the 2015 nuclear deal.
The point which was highlighted during the talks with the coordinator of the JCPOA Joint Commission, Enrique Mora, is that Tehran pursues talks which would produce practical results. The Islamic Republic of Iran does not seek negotiations that would only result in a deal on the paper. The main topic of any talks would be the removal of illegal sanctions which have been imposed on the Islamic Republic over the past years, especially those imposed by former U.S. President Donald Trump under his so-called maximum pressure campaign after leaving the Iran nuclear deal.
Bogheri Kani says Iran has a strong logic based on which it has entered negotiations. The top Iranian negotiator says the Islamic Republic has been committed to the nuclear deal and is standing by the negotiating table. He believes some parties are away from the table either by violating the agreement or failing to live up to their obligations. The talks are expected to resume in late November. Iran and the remaining signatories to the pact have conducted six rounds of negotiations in Vienna with the aim of removing anti-Iran sanctions. Political commentator Sarah Flounder says Iran has the right to demand guarantees that the other parties to the 2015 nuclear deal will not violate an international agreement again.
Iran has every right to demand some kind of guarantees. In 2015, they signed this joint comprehensive plan of action with China, France, Germany, Russia, the UK, and the US. And it was then signed by the UN Security Council, verified by the IAEA. After all of this, the US withdrew unilaterally in May 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Iran. Complete violation of a signed international treaty. And the other signers, the other parties of this treaty, simply sat back and respected the U.S. sanctions, not their agreement with Iran. And it seems Iran is rightfully saying, you know, they'll have a discussion, but they want guarantees that they're countries will abide by the very agreements and treaties that they sign and end the sanctions on Iran. So far, the U.S., the first step, if they want to come back into any kind of discussion, would be to end the sanctions on Iran. And this is what they're not doing.
Iran has criticized the International Atomic Energy Agency for publishing detailed technical information about its nuclear program. Spokesman for the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Behruz Kamalvandi, says such a move runs contrary to the privacy articles of the IAEA's statute. Kamalvandi says Iran is the only country that the agency publishes its sensitive information. He argues that such details are being used to cast doubt on Iran's nuclear activities. The Iranian official has called on the nuclear watchdog to stop the practice, adding that Tehran will take appropriate measures if the agency refuses to do so. A strong rebuke from Lebanon's information minister for Saudi Arabia over its war on Yemen is stirring controversy. In a recent interview, George Kardahi has called the war futile, adding Yemen's Ansarullah law forces are only defending their country against an external aggression led by Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. He has also criticized the Saudi-led military coalition for bombing civilian homes, funerals, and weddings, saying the aggression has to be stopped. Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Bahrain, and Kuwait have reacted to the comments, summoning Lebanon's ambassadors in protest. Riyadh and its regional allies staged a war in Yemen in 2015 in an attempt to reinstate a friendly regime there. Hundreds of thousands of people, most of them civilians, have died, and millions more have been displaced since then. The UN says the war has caused the world's worst humanitarian crisis in Yemen. Moving on, a Saudi prisoner from the Shia community has been released after spending nearly 9 years behind bars. Ali Al-Namer had been locked up since 2012. Namer, who was a child back then, was initially handed down a death sentence along with two other underage Shia citizens. Their charge, participation in anti-government protests. Namer's death penalty was later commuted to jail time. The kingdom announced in 2020 that convicts under the age of 18 would not be handed the death sentence. Ali is a nephew of Shia cleric Namer al-Namer, who was executed by Saudi Arabia 5 years ago. We've spoken with political analyst and Middle East expert Saeed Shahabi. He believes the Saudi government didn't have any reason to keep Ali al-Namer behind bars for almost a decade, during which time he was also severely tortured. Here's more.
This young man has been in custody for almost 10 years for no reason whatsoever. So now, of course, it is a relief that he has not been executed, but for him to be kept all this period behind bars and to be subjected to extensive torture and then unfair trial is in itself a big traumatic event that is likely to remain with him for the rest of his life. So it was a sad episode that they arrested Ali al-Namer shortly after executing around the time of executing his uncle, Sheikh Namer al-Namer. It is one of those episodes that really needs the attention of the world, especially that the decision to kill him and then to commute his sentence and then to release him shows that he was an innocent man. That is for sure. He didn't commit any crime.
Welcome to the news review segment. We are going to delve into one of today's top stories. Syria's ambassador to the United Nations has called for the withdrawal of U.S. and Turkish forces from his country, saying their presence is illegal.
Syria renews its demand to end the illegal presence of American and Turkish forces on our territory and to stop their aggressive practices and their plundering of the country's economic resources and the country's wealth.
Sabah has told a UN Security Council meeting that Turkish forces and militant groups backed by Ankara are obstructing humanitarian access from inside Syria. The envoy also says some Western governments are not living up to their commitments to improve the humanitarian crisis in Syria. Addressing the same meeting, Iran's UN ambassador has condemned the Israeli occupation of Syria's Golan Heights.
The Security Council must live up to its responsibility and compel the Israeli regime to end the occupation of the Syrian Golan and also stop immediately its aggressions against Syria. Aggressions and destabilizing measures of the Israeli regime constitute flagrant violations of international law and continue to threaten regional and international peace and security. We condemn in the strongest terms this criminal act as well as all violations of the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Syria by the Israeli regime and reaffirm Syria's inherent right to self-defense and to respond at the time and place of its choosing.
Taht Ravanchi has also denounced a recent terrorist attack in the Syrian capital Damascus that left 14 people dead. It says the bombing indicates that the fight against terrorist groups in Syria must continue unabated. The Iranian ambassador has further called for the removal of U.S. sanctions on Syria, saying such measures are tantamount to collective punishment. Let me welcome our guests to this edition of News Review. Muhammad Ali is our correspondent in Damascus, joining me via Skype, and Amal Wahdin. She is a member of Syria Solidarity International Movement, joining us from Ramallah. Thank you both for joining this edition of News Review. Let me just start with our correspondent, Muhammad Ali, in Damascus. I want you to tell us how Turkey and the U.S. are plundering Syria's economic resources.
Yes, this is something that has been happening for a long time. The U.S. forces occupying parts of Syria continue to take control of many oil fields, especially in the oil-rich area of Syria that the U.S. is occupying in the northeast over there. There were so many occasions that we've seen a large number of U.S. Trucks and tankers looting Syria's oil outside of Syria and heading towards Iraq. This is, of course, something to be added to the attack that the U.S. carried out and the U.S.-led coalition that destroyed Syria's infrastructure and killed so many civilians also inside the country. Now, of course, the points highlighted by Syria's permanent representative at the United Nations, Dr. Massama Sabah, were not new. However, they were important. He called for ending the illegal presence of the U.S. and Turkish forces in Syria, stopping the aggressive practices, and also stopping the fact they're looting economic resources inside Syria. He also called for a lift of sanctions, the U.S. and EU sanctions on the country. He renewed Syria's condemnation over the escalation in the Israeli attacks on Syria, calling on the U.N. Security Council to shoulder its responsibilities in stopping Israeli aggressions on Syria that actually threaten peace and security. He also called for on the U.N. Security Council to force countries that support terrorism to stop violating international law and to fully implement and respect UN Security Council resolutions related to fighting terrorism. Finally, he said that the US and EU sanctions imposed on the Syrian people, blocking them from getting their basic needs like food, medicine, healthcare, electricity, and fuel, contradicts what they claim that they are keen on improving the humanitarian situation in Syria.
Let me cross over to our guest in Ramallah. Well, as pointed out by Muhammad Ali, Syria is also grappling, or has been grappling, with terrorist groups for quite some time now. And some say that these terrorist groups are backed by the U.S. and Western powers. And this is why Bashar al-Assad has recently said that, you know, the U.S. benefits from war. And war means dollars. War means money to the U.S. How is that so?
Yes, exactly. Actually, this proxy war that started in Syria over 10 years ago now is being backed and financed and supported by the U.S. and its allies. Actually, Turkey played a big role in facilitating the passage of these terrorist groups into Syria. And any war zone, like in Syria, for example, for 10 years means more weapons, you know, selling more weapons to the fighting group and fighting groups, terrorist groups, I mean. And this means at the end, money, while occupation, the real occupation of the U.S. and its allies and its proxy forces in northeast Syria also brings them back profits. They're looting the economic resources of the Syrian people and their natural resources as well. So all these wars that are erupted in the area, basically, and in Syria in particular, makes it profitable for the U.S. and its allies.
Thank you both for joining this edition of News Review. I've been talking to Muhammad Ali, our correspondent, joining us from Damascus, and Amal Wahdan. She is a member of Syria Solidarity International Movement, who just joined us from Ramallah. Tensions escalating between China and the U.S. over Taiwan. Beijing says official exchanges and military contacts between Washington and Taipei in any form or level are not acceptable. Beijing is asking Washington to keep away from its internal affairs and avoid moves that stir up trouble. China's foreign ministry says the U.S. should not underestimate the strong determination of the Chinese people to defend their national sovereignty and territorial integrity. It says the One China principle is the political foundation of Beijing-Washington relations. The reaction comes in response to Taiwan's president admitting for the first time that U.S. military trainers are present on the island.
Does that support include sending some U.S. service members to help train Taiwanese troops?
Well, yes. We have a wide range of cooperation with the U.S. aiming at increasing our defense capability.
How many U.S. service members are deployed in Taiwan right now?
Not as many as people thought.
Tsai Ing-wen tells CNN that the threat from China is growing every day, but that she is prepared for more communication with the Chinese government to reduce misunderstandings. Earlier this month, the U.S. media first reported that American forces have been secretly training Taiwanese troops for months. Washington has no formal diplomatic ties with Taiwan, but is its main ally an arms supplier. Beijing's stance on the island, though, is unwavering. It says Taiwan is part of China and should quit its bid for independence. A post-Brexit dispute over fishing rights between Paris and London once again flaring up. France now says it has fined two British boats fishing off its port, Le Havre. France gave verbal warnings to the vessels on Wednesday. The maritime police then detained and escorted one of them back to the harbor. London says it is investigating the incident. Tensions have been simmering between the two neighbors over post-Brexit trade arrangements. France is demanding more licenses for its vessels to access British waters. It's even threatening to block British boats from its ports and tighten security checks on its trucks if there is no agreement by next week. Britain says it is disappointed at the Paris decision, calling it a violation of trade deals and international law. Closed stores and few people on the streets of Moscow as Russia orders the temporary closure of non-essential services to stem a COVID surge. The Kremlin is cautioning Russians against traveling during the non-working period. There's been a sudden rise in COVID cases and deaths in recent weeks. A new all-time high for daily fatalities was reported a couple of days ago. The country is now looking to contain the new peak with fresh lockdown measures. The total number of deaths is nearing 234,000. That's the fourth highest in the world. And the overall infections are hovering above 8 million. That does it for this edition of World News. Thanks for your company.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing the Maribor Uprisings, directed by Maple Raza and Milton Gillen. And joining me in the studio, we have Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Guardian and The Telegraph. And beside him is Maurice McLeod, who is a social commentator and director of Media Diversified. He is also the vice chair of social policy research organization Race on the Agenda. Now, the Maribor Uprising shows how in the once prosperous industrial city of Maribor, which is Slovenia's second largest city, anger over political corruption turned into a revolt against the mayor, the violent police forces, and the corrupt political elite. This documentary places audiences in the midst of the uprising as crowds surround and ransack the city hall under a hailstorm of tear gas canisters. The Maribor Uprisings raises many questions faced by these events and by the uprisings elsewhere, from the Arab Spring through Paris to Black Lives Matter.
When we watched the images from the protests of the Arab Spring, Greece and Occupy, we were certain that nothing like that could happen here. That is, until they installed the new stationary radar system, which sent speeding tickets right to your home, 70,000 in the first weeks of operation. Then we found out that 90% of the proceeds went to a private contractor, not to our city. Then we learned the mayor had close ties to the private contractor. Then we heard he was running for the National Council, which would give him immunity from prosecution. Then we heard where this was happening, and we went there to stop it. Twice we went into the streets. Twice the police drove us away. Twice the news media, embedded behind police lines, portrayed us all as hooligans and criminals.
We formed a video collective because things looked very different on our side of the police lines. All the footage in this documentary is shot by people like me. People like you. I invite you to join us as we record a new uprising, the third uprising, organized on Facebook and called for tonight. You'll decide how you participate.
Will you stay here and film with the people fighting to hold the square? Or do you go to record those who are seeking safety further to the south?
First of all, welcome to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. So we're in this show, we're reviewing the theatrical version of the documentary. It was initially screened as an interactive film, which gave the audience a chance to make decisions throughout the film. And Mike, if I could start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, I mean, it's interesting, there are two different versions of this film, and I think the version that we saw is an imperfect version in that, you know, it has the rough edges that I would associate with activist and collective-derived filmmaking, the rough edges that I think the filmmakers would say authenticizes that the action.
Would you say that by the style of the filmmaking? And
yeah.
That it was done with smartphones? And
exactly, yeah. It's shot on
cameras.
The fly, and, you know, there's no sort of calculated camera movements, any of the sort of slickness that you would get with more commercially-minded documentary, I think. There's something missing in terms of what we actually get, in terms of what the protesters are protesting against, I think. We get mentioned very early on a certain amount of public money being spent on radar systems. Beyond that, there's a kind of generalized dissatisfaction and grumbling with the administration. So maybe that was all addressed in the interactive version, and we didn't get that. What it has, and what really is its strength, is the sense of absolutely being caught up in the middle of something. And in the middle of something that I think is sort of quite localized. We've seen a lot of films about protest movements in the last few years, things like We Are Many, about the Iraq War, the protests against that, The Square, about the Arab Spring, Maidan, Ukraine. But they're all big, epic movies. This is much more localized. It feels like the kind of protest that you and your friends could organize, mm-hmm. or that you and your friends could you know, rock up to on a Saturday afternoon and participate in. And that's a strength of the film, I think.
So do you think this film serves as a valuable tool for audiences who haven't experienced the protests firsthand?
Yeah, I think so. I think this is one of the reasons why it exists in several forms. It's a very good point of entry, I think, for people who haven't necessarily been on many protests and may be coming to a protest for the first time, but do feel they have got something to say and something to share. And it shows you all the avenues you can go down in the course of one afternoon or one evening's protest. Mm.
And Marie, sorry, if I could turn to you now. As someone who advocates for racial equality and justice, what was your take on this documentary?
Yeah, I found it interesting. Like you say, that it was very bitty, but that was its nature and that's how it should be. It very much felt like you were in the protest, and I thought we didn't get the full interactive side of things, but that really felt like you were making decisions and you were in amongst it. There were bits, like you say, there were bits missing for me. I would like to have known a little bit more. I think if it were made commercially or whatever, there'd been a bit more about the history, a bit more about how they got into that situation. And yes, you understood that there was corruption and that people were feeling aggrieved, but I thought there could have been a little bit more to show how they ended up in the protest, because one of the big points they made was that people didn't expect the police to behave so violently, that it was a prosperous city and people were kind of used to, since 1991, the end of Yugoslavia, they'd had their independence and freedom, and they felt very empowered, and suddenly, well, maybe not suddenly, but as the corruption became more and more obvious, the protests grew and ended up pretty violent. I thought that was gathered quite well. So you felt very much like, well, why is this happening? And but maybe with a bit more background from before, you would have got that a bit more. I felt like that was missing a little bit. It's sort of you're plonked right into the middle of it, and it's like, okay, you know,
you're figuring things out for yourself.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
That
totally
was intentional.
Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. Which I guess, if it were a real protest, you know, that's exactly what happens. You're like, well, do I want to go down there?
There's a lot of moral questions, and there's lots to grapple with. And I think perhaps the abstract and philosophical nature of the documentary is a credit to it, and that's the kind of questions it raises. So we really get the sense of desperation and the sense of urgency for their need and want for change in the country. And we also get the sense that nothing has changed for a really long time, and he even suggests that something more radical needs to be done. Mike, I know Maurice mentioned that there isn't a lot of political context, but is there something, there's a need for these people to drive out to the streets?
Yes, I mean, very early on there's a quote where one of the protesters says, you know, we detected this growing chasm between what we want and what the world around us is. And so the entire film becomes a sort of disquisition into, well, how do you fix that gap? How do you bridge that gap? And one of the ways is to look around at the people around you, and they start looking out to one another and making their own images. Now, the protests that we see here come at a very crucial time in Maribor's history. We learn that they've just been named European City of Culture. Mm-hmm. It's often the case that these big moments tend to sort of focus a lot of energy in this way. I was thinking sort of the run-up to the 2012 Olympics in London. There was a lot of unrest before that. There were protests before the 2016 Olympics in Rio. What we're dealing with here is a contrast between the official version of events, the image that the authorities want to show to the world, and what the people actually on the street are seeing in their day-to-day reality. And one of the ways you bridge that gap is by making your own images. And this is exactly, I think, what this film is doing. It's showing you the images, the reality, as seen by people on the streets who just weren't happy with the image the authorities were projecting outwards to the world.
And Maurice, would you agree with Mike said?
Absolutely.
Do you think there's universal aspects to this protest?
I think there are very universal aspects to the protest. I would add to what you're saying in that this was the third protest, and as they said in the trailer, the other two protests had been, you know, filmed by the standard media, and they felt that they weren't representing what was actually going on. So people took control and made their own media. That's great. That's the way forward. And the universality of that is that's what happens now in protest. It's no longer is it, well, let's see what the BBC are saying about, you know, our protest. People get on and do it themselves, and we have the ability now to do that. Maybe not as joined up as a documentary like this, but you know, most protests now, if I were watching a protest, I would go online and I'd watch someone who was there, and I, you know, rather than watching the sanitized version, or the version that we know is spun to some extent. There's a lot in that. There's a lot in, let's get our own messages across. Let's film our own stuff. Let's show our own images and tell our own stories. That's universal, and that's mm-hmm. certainly came across, I thought.
Well, that's a really good point.
I knew that people went into the streets in Cairo, Athens, Paris, and Ferguson for such different reasons. But when I watch their footage, it still reminds me of our experience. I mean, in each city, it was the reaction of the police that turned protests into uprisings.
And Mike, what can you tell us about the way the police are portrayed?
Well, it, for all the sort of rough edges of the film, in many ways, it's a very classical three-act narrative. So the first act is getting people out on the streets. The second act is what then happens once all these people are out on the streets. How do you control that mass of people? And there's, very early on, a fear amongst the protesters that there might be some kind of violent action. Mm-hmm. I was surprised, actually, that there are one or two clips where you actually see the policeman liaising with the protesters and coming over to the protesters and saying, can you just tone it down a bit? Which, you know, I think if a film was determined to demonise the police force, they wouldn't have those little clips in. But at the same time, we do see a good deal of violent action like that. And as the narrative says, you know, these are the actions that turn a protest into an uprising and have this sort of violent reaction. So I think it achieves a balance. You do get a sense of, you know, the immense amount of fear on both sides, I think, once huge amounts of people take to the streets.
Mm-hmm. And Maurice, but I was getting this impression that the filmmakers had a sense of betrayal and shock by the police force. Mm-hmm. They expected them to be the people's protector, but then they suddenly turned on them and suppressed their voices. What did you make of this?
Yeah, there was a very specific moment, wasn't it, where the narrator said that they came under attack and it surprised them that they reacted exactly the same as the other protested and started defending themselves. And she talks about love and the barricades. And, you know, you look at the person next to you, if they, you know, you're being pelted with tear gas or whatever, and they pick up a tear gas and throw it back, it's a very natural thing. You feel very, connected mm-hmm. to the people next to you, and that really came across. It didn't feel at all, and I don't think it needs to, it didn't feel like an objective view of what was going on. It was like, this is from inside, this is what we're seeing, and that really came across, I felt. But yeah, the police violence, I mean, as a lot of the people interviewed said, that's what really made this into a major protest, because it sounded like people were kind of disgruntled and were cross with the mayor, and then the police reacted in a very strong way, which shocked everyone, which made a counter reaction, which is often the case, isn't it? It's often, I mean, look at Catalonia or something, it's often the case that the way the authorities deal with what could be, you know, perfectly reasonable protests ends up sparking something quite bigger.
So we see this in lots of protests, mass protests, Black Lives Matter, the Arab Spring, etc. Mike, did you want to add something?
Well, there's a visual contrast in the film as well. Because we're getting lots of different opinions from the protesters, they're a very diverse lot. Whereas when we see the police, they're all there dressed alike, they're all in uniform, they're all lined up together, moving forward silently. They become this kind of anonymous threat. Mm-hmm. And that's a very sort of effective little tool in the middle, going on in the middle of the film.
It would have been nice, I thought, maybe in the interactive part this happens somewhere. It would have been nice to have seen more from the police. Because there was a bit that I saw where a protester said to, trying to converse with a police officer, he says, take your helmet off, come and talk to us.
I'd
like to have seen more of that, because those police surely work and live in the area. I'm always interested in what makes the authority figure, who's still a human, look at someone that they, you know, that they, one of their fellow citizens, and think, no, you're violent, and I'm going to hit you. How can we bridge that gap? I'd like to have seen more from the police side of things.
You mentioned violence. I want to touch on that issue, because I think one of the questions the film raises is this issue of peaceful, artful protest versus violent protest. Where do you weigh in on this debate?
Yeah, it's a constant thing, isn't it, to be honest? Whenever there's, you know, when Ferguson happens, it's like, well, they've got a right to protest, but they haven't got a right to throw anything. And I feel like in my work, I'm constantly defending people's right to protest. And sometimes those protests get carried away because emotions are high and, you know, actions and reactions, like we've just said. Mm-hmm. I can understand. I thought the film did it quite well when it asked the question. It didn't say, yeah, violence, of course this should happen. It said, well, what's the difference between this person and that person? You went that way and they went that way, and you know, they got caught up and threw a tear gas canister back and you didn't. So it tried to make a link, I think, between the protesters, whether they were violent or not violent. I thought that was kind of interesting, quite a brave thing to do for a documentary.
No, very clever.
It opens them up to criticism, I would imagine.
So it's not black and white, it's a complex issue with different layers.
A few days after the third uprising, the one we helped film, Mayor Kangler resigned and a candidate associated with the protests was elected mayor. Across Slovenia, 50 other towns organized uprisings under the slogan Gotovisa, they're finished. The prime minister was swept up in a corruption scandal of his own, his coalition government collapsed, and he was voted out of power. So the initial demands of the uprisings were met, even exceeded.
So after all of that, it seems as though the protests didn't really work. Mike, are you convinced they had an impact?
Well, this is the surprise third act. We're talking about a three-act structure. Generally, these kind of protest movies end with some kind of flag-waving triumph, some sort of great note of hope that the audience can carry away with them. And what happens here is that the protesters meet their aims, but they do so in a way that they don't necessarily expect, and that's the big surprise of the film. So it's not this triumph. It is more of a sort of scored roar that sort of they model through it. And what you get a sense of is the filmmakers trying to preserve everything that they've learnt in the course of the journey, in the course of the protest, so that future protesters can come out and see the film and have a sense of, well, you don't win every time. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you win in a way that you don't expect. Sometimes, you know, it's that old thing about life being the thing that happens when you're busy making plans. And this is absolutely reflected in the film.
Mm. And Maurice, what did you think of this sort of ending towards of the documentary?
I thought it was successful, even though, not much changed in the lives of the protesters. I mean, that's the thing that leaves you thinking, well, what was it for? But as they said, they achieved all of their goals. Mm-hmm. Maybe their goals were too short term, changing the mayor and removing the radar cameras.
Of it seems a bit superficial. Some of the changes, like a political reshuffle.
Yeah.
Do you think the film therefore has a wider message about lack of trust in the political establishment?
Oh, certainly. I mean, that was evident that they, as the woman was saying there, they've replaced corrupt leaders with other corrupt leaders. But I felt that the documentary did mention this, that that's not the only point of the protest. It's also, it brought people together, it showed that they actually do have some agency and can affect change, even if it's only on a superficial level. Mm-hmm. There was someone talking about the social, the community type changes that they felt had happened since the protest, that people felt more engaged with each other's lives and more involved. Someone's talking about family history that they started discussing since the protest. I think that sort of stuff often gets ignored. You go, did you win or did you not win? Something just in coming together is important.
It's about, I think we've been schooled to expect instant gratification. And I think one of the things that the film shows is that you can't have an easy win all the time. Sometimes it's a cumulative effect of small victories that build up to something that lasts, that's worthwhile. And I think that's the kind of victory that happens here. Yeah.
And what other kind of wider lessons can we learn from this documentary, do you think, on the act of protest? Especially at a time like now, this political climate, where we see protests constantly.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure. I'm not sure I watched it thinking, what can I learn about protest? I don't know. I think it asks you questions. I think that's more what the documentary is. It says to you, what do you think about this? What do you think about violence? What do you think about this? What would make you uprise? Do you think this could happen? All those sorts of questions are really pertinent. I watched it and it made me explore thoughts that I was already having about protests and stuff. Mm-hmm. That's all very good, and it made me think about it from a context which I had no real connection to. I had no real connection to Maribor, and no real knowledge of their protests. So it was good looking at it from clearing out the emotion that maybe is in some of the protests that I do get involved in, like the Black Lives Matter stuff. Clearing away some of that and going, okay, in this instance, this is how it happened. And like she said, I was amazed by how much it still felt very similar. It felt very familiar, and and the reactions and the anger of the crowd, all of that is exactly the same. So it, I felt it did a very good job at getting that across. I don't feel like it was offering a judgment on protest. I don't feel like that was the point of it. I think it was more, I know, the anatomy of a protest, or, you know, it was more explaining how it developed and ended up.
That's really interesting. So it's open to interpretation and it's relative to everyone's experience. And Mike, final 30 seconds to you. Would you recommend this documentary?
Certainly. I mean, I would very much now like to go and do the interactive version so I could sort of negotiate my way through the situation as it developed and see how things changed and how it changed my opinion as well. But as a starting point, it's well worth seeing.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this episode. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. Don't forget to leave a comment and your thoughts regarding our show. I've been Camila Shambiati.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents. For humanity. Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We were looking at human rights from the scope and the ideology of the commander of the faithful Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. We were talking about how he valued the human life to the extent that when he wrote his covenant to Malik al-Ashtar, he gave him a set of instructions that he needs to deal with people. I want to look at part of it, and he says, he who takes the blood of a person and sheds the blood of a person, and he talks about the afterlife, obviously. He says, Wallahu subhanahu wa ta'ala mubtadi'un bil hukm bayn al ibad. When it comes to Allah on Day of Judgment, the first thing Allah will judge upon, or the first thing, or the first law or order of law in the court of God will be what? He says, Fima tasafaku min ad-dima', when it comes to them and the bloodshed that they've done. So anyone who has taken the blood of another human being or the life of another human being, he will be the first or among the first in line to be judged. And then he says, فَلَا تُقَوِّيَنَّ سُلْطَانَكَ بِسَفْكِ دَمٍ حَرَامٍ. Do not enforce your rule by trying to shed blood. فَإِنَّ ذَلِكَ مِمَّا يَضْعُفُهُ. For that, it will actually weaken it. وَيُهَنَ. And it will humiliate such a system. Any system, any dictatorship system that's past and that even current, when you look at them, first, they are weak, they're not strong for shedding the blood of innocent people. And everyone looks down on them. We don't look at Hitler, for example, or Mussolini and all these bloodbaths. And even today, when you look at our current bloodbath leaders, like, you know, the Americans, for example, the American system, the American presidents, and the Jews, for example, and even some of the Arab leaders who shed the blood of innocent people, that doesn't make them stronger. It makes them weaker and actually humiliates them. And when it comes to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, they will get the punishment. Well, from this itself, from this passage in the covenant to Michael Ashtar, we learn a few things. One, the emphasis on the fact that shedding blood is forbidden, and not just the blood of a Muslim, because the context of the letter or the covenant is general. Safku dima is general. He did not say safku dima al-Muslimin. He did not specify. So it applies to everybody. So the right of life is guaranteed for all, not just the Muslims. One. Two, when it comes to the ruler himself, he's not exempted. It doesn't mean he can kill his servants or kill his subjects or kill the people under him or his citizens. He is not exempted. If a ruler or a king or a president, whoever he might be, if he commits a crime, if he kills a person, takes the life of a person, he needs to be punished. His life needs to be taken as a result. So he kind of, Amir al-Mu'mineen in this passage, he equalized between that which is governing and he who is governed. So the governor and the governed, and they're both the same when it comes to applying the laws in the sight of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. Let us take a break, then we continue inshallah.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We were looking at the letter or the covenant that Amir al-Mu'minin wrote to his companion Malik al-Ashtar as he was sending him as a governor to Egypt. And also among the things that we can derive from this letter is the fact that shedding blood is always a calamity that befalls on a nation. It's always something that brings the wrath of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Not only the wrath of Allah, but the wrath of people and the wrath of other nations. In fact, it will lead to people being divided from within. It creates a sense of pollution. It pollutes the environment and the society that people live in. And even Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi, and because this will lead to trying to get revenge yourself if someone kills for you, also if we kill someone, obviously he would have family and, you know, people that wouldn't want to take revenge from me. So it will create a very unstable society. For that, Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi says, لِكُلِّ دَمٍ ثَائِرٍ, for every blood that's spilled, for every life that's taken, there's someone that will stand up for that blood. Back in the day, wars used to rage for months and months and years because one person from another tribe killed another person from another tribe. And we even have it here where if, for example, one citizen of a country gets killed, the other country retaliates and they, you know, start to bombard the other country. And we saw that in our recent history happening. So every blood, Amir al-Mu'minin says, it has a tha'ir, someone that will take the revenge for it. وَلِكُلِّ حَقٍ طَالِبٍ, for every right, there's someone that seeks it. Someone will seek his right. If you take the right of other people, they will become an asking for it. Now, this whole concept of people taking revenge or people seeking their rights, it means there's a collision, there's a problem between people themselves that led them to this notion of trying to get the rights from others and others depriving them of their rights. Or a person is asking to shed a life or the blood of another person and take their life as in a way to take revenge for the life that was taken from them, and so on and so forth. Therefore, the Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi, we see that even when it comes to people who incite hatred and incite the notion of killing to others, Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi used to punish them. We'll leave it here and we will continue in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
صلي يا ربي على طه الأمين رحمة أرسلته للعالمين وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.